WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The 84-year-old male charged with shooting 16-year-old Ralph Jarl when the black teen went to his door by mistake has entered a not guilty plea. Jarl family attorney Lee Merritt.
The reason that we're here is because so many people stood up and said that this is not okay. And we need them to say the same thing next month, and next week, and next year. We need to be committed to this long term.
Civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump filing a $500 million lawsuit against the city of Memphis and its police department on behalf of the family of Tyre Nichols.
For the torture, savage, brutal, dehumanizing, extrajudicial killing of Tyre Nichols.
Sources tell ABC News that a supervisor at the IRS has told lawmakers he has information suggesting the Biden administration could be mishandling the investigation into Hunter Biden. This is ABC News. Tesla stock slipped after the electric car maker cut prices for two models ahead of first quarter earning results that show net earnings and income fell more than 20% compared to last year. Ventura County, California investigators allege a man intentionally drove into a group of high school students.
A 15-year-old boy was killed and others hurt when a car slammed into a group outside of Westlake High School in Thousand Oaks. The driver, investigators say, was 24-year-old Austin Ice, who was on a crime spree and had stabbed a Walmart employee beforehand, and now they think he intentionally hit the students. Eric Berg is a sophomore.
I hear people screaming and running, and then I turn around and I just see this big white car just barreling towards me, and there's debris flying everywhere.
Ice was arrested at the crash site and is now facing multiple charges, including murder. Alex Stone, ABC News, Los Angeles.
The Foo Fighters have announced a new album, the first since drummer Taylor Hawkins died in March of 2022. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin is under a state of emergency due to fast-rising floodwaters. The snowpack in northern Wisconsin has been melting rapidly in the last week, and we've had our share of rain. Wisconsin Emergency Management, the National Guard, and several other state agencies are standing by to offer local communities help if they need it. A bill to increase penalties for carjacking in Wisconsin is on its way to Governor Evers' desk. Convicts would face up to 60 years in prison.
Years ago, I would take my kids when they were growing up, we would go down and we would stay down in downtown Milwaukee or downtown Chicago. I don't think you could pay me to go down there now.
Republican Paul Tittle of Manitowoc, the bill has bipartisan support, but some Democrats complain it demonizes Milwaukee. In sports, the Brewers go for a sweep of Seattle today. Tonight, the Bucks try to even up their first-round playoff series against Miami. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come take it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Happy 419 Day. A special shout out to our listeners on WAKT 106.1 in Toledo, our 419 friends. Because look, you know, I'm thrilled that 419 Day went this way, because I got to tell you, little concerned about terrorist activity. Really concerned about things going boom. But you know, trust me, our GOP friends, they're working on it. And we'll get to some of that. But here's the thing, and this is the thing it's driving me nuts. You see the numbers coming out about, you know, everyone thinks the economy's terrible. The most recent polling is, you know, everything's horrible, everything's bad, everything's terrible. And the news, I believe it's our news culture. You know, I was just before we went on air, I was just looking over at the AP. And, you know, the U.S. News, the AP, the headlines, homeowner shot black teen, pleads not guilty. Can a doorbell justify standing your ground? Tyre Nichols' family sues the Memphis police. Florida expands don't say gay. Woman shot after wrong turn. Police in Maine, man killed parents before firing on motorists. Supreme Court extends the abortion pill. You know, again, the court weighs in on abortion pills. Fox settlement, fury of lawsuits over election lies. Semi-automatic rifle ban passes in Washington State Legislature. House GOP can question the Trump guy. The prosecutor, California city audits sent racist, abusive texts. Nothing, literally nothing in our media about our economy and what the administration is doing. Nothing about the fact that the Republicans are doing everything they can do to hold us hostage. Nothing. You know, and I'm looking through this. It's all shootings. It's all horrible. It's all negative stuff. And I understand. You know, Rick, come on. You know better. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, if it's divisive, it's what sells. You know, they need clickbait. And I do. But today, I gotta tell you, today was the day. If you really needed something divisive, if you really needed something to pit Democrats and Republicans against each other, if you really needed to get the red hats and the blue hats pointing at each other, today was the day. Because we find out now what Speaker McCarthy's plan is. And Congressman Chris DeLuzio, who we're going to have on the program either tomorrow or Friday, he was testifying saying, look, I'm told that they're going to cut the VA's budget by 22%. That's going to mean 13 million fewer healthcare visits, longer benefit wait times, and VA staffing cuts. They're already 50,000 people short at the VA, and they're going to have staffing cuts? This is where you go, what the Seriously. House Republicans are making no carve-outs for the for vets. Now, remember, these are the people that we put up on a pedestal. We said, no, no, you go off and you go fight for freedom and terrorism and all the stuff we shoved down their throats and said, don't worry, we will take care of you. We will take care of your families. We've got your back. Do we? A 22% across the board cut. Now, this is the part that's really just infuriating. Because you've got McCarthy, who I guess they're trying to move this Limit, Save, Grow Act of 2023, which they say will cut discretionary spending, take back some of the pandemic money that wasn't spent, eliminate Biden's student loan plan, and, of course, go after the IRS. And they claim that's going to save $4.5 trillion. Do you know how much discretionary spending you're going to have to cut to get $4.5 trillion? Considering we only spend about $1.6 trillion a year on what is considered discretionary spending. So literally you could cut it all out and it's not going to get to where he's going to get in 1, 2, 3 years. Well, it would take almost 3 years of zero. Now, here we are at this point. They know they've got the country by the short hairs. They have this artificial debt ceiling, $31.4 trillion we've already hit it back in February, and the Treasury Department went and did a whole bunch of what they called extraordinary measures to help pay the bills and, you know, start, you know, doing some slicing and dicing and what, and we're going to hit the point of no return, no ability to meet our obligations sometime in June. And Republicans know this. They know that they're going to be able to hold the country hostage. This is terrorism. This is economic terrorism at its worst. Because they know they can hold the country hostage. My fear is, and I remember when John Boehner did this and got the sequester, or as I affectionately call screwquester, because it really screwed especially veterans. They were willing to push us off the cliff. But I honestly didn't believe they wanted to do it. I didn't believe they wanted to shoot the hostage. I look at the current makeup of the Republican Party and these Kook Caucus folks, the Greens and the Boberts and the Go-Gomerts and the rest of them, the Scott Perrys, I think they want to shoot the hostage. I think they want to push the button. I think they want to push us over the, I think they really want to default. Because they want the economy to be so bad so they can blame it on Joe Biden. Most people I talk to, they're getting by. They're struggling. Prices are way too high. But I think they're coming around to the reality that corporate America is gouging their eyes out. That it's not something that Joe Biden did. It certainly wasn't the $1,400. It's not the investment in infrastructure. It's not the investment in reshoring manufacturing. That it's good old-fashioned American corporate greed that's doing this to them. And Republicans need to have this cataclysmic event. They need to have chaos. Because, again, now understand, they've got the House. They could push an agenda to go, hey, this is going to help with inflation. But all they're talking about is painful cuts. I mean, painful cuts. When you look at the reality, at the discretionary budget, of the discretionary budget, now understand, the discretionary budget is only about 35% of all of our spending. 65% of the spending is mandatory. There's nothing you can do about it. It's being spent regardless. The discretionary budget part of it, 57% of it goes to the military. Now you throw in the military, you throw in the VA, you throw in Homeland Security, you're now talking about 68% of the discretionary budget being spent on military-type stuff. So what does that mean? That means everything else is going to get slashed and burned. It means that's what their goal is. Now remember, you know, discretionary spending back in 1962 was a total of 47% of our income. 47%. Now you go, whoa. Yes, discretionary spending has been going down. We've been cutting spending for decades. It was, you know, Reagan era forward. It was slash programs. It was burn programs. It was steal food out of the mouths of children because now ketchup is a vegetable. It was doing all of those things. And you get into the you get into the Clinton years, and we're going after the welfare mothers, and we're going after all of the programs that they could get to screw over the working poor. And then, interestingly enough, you know, during the Bush years, we get a tiny bump because, it was too bad. And then we've got the Bush collapse, and it spikes up a little bit. Still not to where it was back during the 60s and early 70s and into the 80s. Certainly not. And we're now down to almost half of the percentage we were at the high. And you still have people going, we spend too much. No. We spend a lot more on military than we ever did. And we're still running up debt. The difference is we're not taxing the wealthy. You go back to the high of discretionary spending. We had a marginal tax rate of 70% during the 70s and into the Reagan era. We had a way to pay our bills to ensure that we could afford education, that we could get health care because we had community hospitals to pay for, that we could invest in the future. But then we went tax cut fetish. Oh, boy, got to create a billionaire class. And boy, have we ever. We've got the biggest, most robust billionaire class ever. And you did that. I did that. Working people did that. Well, they did it because we've gotten less. And what the Republican mindset has always been is less for the working class and more for the wealth class. And I love the fact that, you know, again, they wrap themselves in the flag whenever there's a troop, when the troops are around, got to get the photo op, and, you know, salute and stand tall and, you know, all that stuff. But when it comes to taking care of them, what they're doing is no different than what happened when the guys came back from Vietnam and were dumped into my housing project. They're starving these programs, and they're doing it on purpose because they know they can. And this is why I'm happy that Biden is not backing down. This, again, is another one of those moments where I'm glad Joe Biden is in the White House because saying, look, you know, this isn't happening. He was quoted today saying MAGA Republicans in Congress are threatening to default on the national debt, the debt that took 230 years to accumulate overall. Unless we do what they say, they're going to default unless I agree to all these wacko notions that they have. And they do have a bunch of wacko notions. 22% cut across the board. Again, $4.5 trillion from the discretionary budget. It's not going to come out of the military budget. Trust me on that. So what does that mean? That means transportation. That means agriculture. That means food stamps for kids. That means school lunch programs. That means LIHEAP. That means go down the list of what it means, of what little is left of our social safety net. This is the goal. And they know that their cult are okay with this because they don't believe it's them. And this is the part that's really just kind of freaky. They don't believe that it's going to affect them without thinking that, you know what, it's just going to roll down onto the states. It's just going to roll down into more desperation and more anger and more violence and more division. It only gets worse. And this is where I come back to this moment. Something has to be done to end these ticking bomb down to the last minute hostage situations. It's not good for our economy. It's not good for the global economy. And it's not good for policymaking. They should scrap the debt ceiling entirely. Do you know when you fight overspending? Before you spend it. And this is the weird little world that we're in. They want to hold the country hostage over money that's already being spent. It would be like you running up your credit card and then going, you know, I don't think I'm going to pay it. And they think you're going to be okay with that. From economists that I've talked to, if we default, unemployment is going to skyrocket. You know, the cost of money is going to go through the roof. our credit rating is going to take a massive dump, which means all of the money that we do owe will accelerate. And none of this is good. And you go, but Rick, you know, 69% of the public already thinks the economy's bad. Well, if Republicans get their way, I think it'll be 90% who think the economy is going in the wrong way. And again, they've come up with no other alternative ideas because the Republican Party is devoid of any idea. Want to hear your thought. Do you think this is going to go down to the wire? Do you think they'll default? Do you think like I do that they really want to shoot the hostage? And that's you and me, by the way. I kind of think they do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
New USA Today Suffolk University poll out. Joe Biden is leading the Democratic primary field with 67% of Democrats. RFK Jr., he's at 14, and Marianna Williamson is at 5. And this is just blowing my mind. And I gotta think, just because the Kennedy name is attached to this guy, that's why people would vote for him. Because someone on my Facebook feed put up, "Oh, RFK Jr.'s running. This is great," and everybody lambasted them, especially because of the fact that this guy is Steve Bannon's hand-picked choice to run in this primary. Not because he wants him to win, but because he wants to tear into Biden. Please don't come at me with RFK Jr. If you want, I like Marianna Williamson. When she talks about economics, when she talks about how the working class has been getting screwed over, she's not wrong. She is spot on 100%. She could sit here and do my shtick. But ultimately, if Biden runs, I think he's the nominee. And we'll see. We'll see if it's a Trump-Biden runoff. Willie, listening on WCPT AM 820 in Chicago, sent me an email, said, "Rick, when will Americans finally have enough gun death? When will Americans get fed up and repeal the Second Amendment?" Wow. This is out of hand. Thank you for your sanity on this issue and your continued focus, but I think you are trying to find common ground with unreasonable people. I don't disagree with you, Willie, not even a little bit. There are some people who are completely unreasonable and you cannot deal with them. But there are I know some gun people who are just as fed up. Look, when the headlines today are a 65-year-old guy shoots and kills a girl in a car that had the audacity to back up in his driveway, when an 85-year-old shoots a guy who had the audacity to knock on his door of the wrong house, when someone shoots and kills a 6-year-old and the 6-year-old's parents because a basketball rolled into their yard, when 4 in Alabama are killed and 28 more are injured at a Sweet 16 party for who knows what reason, and I could go on and on. What happened up in Maine, they're it's all over the place. And look, Willie, you're one of the first people I've heard say repeal the Second Amendment. I'm not even there because I don't think it's possible. But is there a breaking point? Is there a point at which people go, man, we really cannot handle this responsibility? It's gotten to, is there a point? Is there a point where it gets out of hand? And I don't know. I'm already there. I think we should already have background checks and red flag laws and all kinds of stuff. What's interesting, people in Georgia, they believe that they can challenge their neighbor that they don't know, thousands of them, because, you know, for their right to vote. But if, you know, the neighbor's got an arsenal and is espousing, you know, white nationalist views and, you know, wanting to blow things up, sorry, nothing we can do. Nothing. But I'm with you, Willie. Something does have to be done. Paul, listening on KCAA in the Inland Empire, San Bernardino, he writes, Rick, awesome show. We listen every day in the garage and wanted to get your thoughts on the claim that Biden is the most pro-union president in history. There are Amazon workers out here holding actions and engaging in strikes, but it doesn't seem to be getting them anywhere. Is there anything the president could do to help us? What would you do? Well, since you asked, Paul, I would, and I said this from the beginning, I would use executive action. No legislation is going to happen. You're never going to get Joe Manchin to come along, even though West Virginia has an incredibly strong union history. The UMWA is extremely strong in West Virginia, even though they don't represent many people. The legacy, the history, the pride that goes into that is still there. And again, he's not voting for it. So legislatively, you're not getting anything done. So you have to use executive action. You have to use the authority that the president has. And what I would do, and I've said this on a whole bunch of things, we spend a lot of money as the federal government. And it's a good thing that we do. We have the ability to attach, you know, conditions to that money. We've said in the past, you can't pay below a certain wage. With prevailing wage laws, we say you've got to pay a prevailing wage with benefits and working conditions and all kinds of things go along with that. We could simply do that across the economy. And I've been saying this for a long time, that the president could say, look, you know, Amazon, you get a ton of federal money, tons of it, through your cloud program, through all of your tax breaks, through all of the business you do with the federal government. You're going to remain neutral in a union organizing campaign. And any company that does business with the federal government would have to maintain a neutrality position. Because understand, the reason that unions exploded in the 30s and 40s was because government was actively encouraging people to join. Because that is the law. It's the law. The NLRA is about promoting unionism, getting people to collectively bargain. Because understand, it was a peace treaty. There were people literally brick by brick tearing the country apart. There were strikes going on. There were sit downs. There was all kinds of stuff. And the NLRA was that, hey, this is how we're going to solve that unrest. We're going to bring people to the table. They're going to sit down face to face. We're going to put them on somewhat equal terms, and they're going to hammer it out. Companies are going to open their books. Employees are going to get a little bit better off. Everybody's going to do better. That whole win-win. We do better when we do better. And it worked. It worked for a generation. Worked for two generations. I benefited from the end of it. Because when I started working back in the 80s, we were still about 25% unionized as a country. We're down to 6.6% in the private sector. Not because people don't want to join unions, but because union avoidance, these companies hiring these union busting firms to come in and harass and intimidate and break the law. And as I've said before, if you're one of these union busting companies, it would be political malpractice not to advise an employer to fire people, because there's no penalty. There's no cost to this. A little slap on the wrist, a promise not to do it again. Maybe you got to post a note, say, I won't do it again until I do it again. So for me, it all comes back down to ball executive action. The president has done some things. I think he can do an awful lot more. I think he really screwed up with the railroad situation. I would have advised much differently. But for me, executive action is the way that things are going to have to go until we can actually find people to vote their pocketbooks. And look, all we're being fed, you look at the mainstream media, all we're being fed is division. and tearing us apart. The economy, stupid. That's what brings us back together. Ensuring that we got decent wages, better conditions, healthcare benefits, retirement security. These are the things that could bring us back together. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day Edna Sauls and 38 women walked into the Virginia headquarters of the Pittston Coal Group, sat down in the lobby, and sang We Shall Not Be Moved. Their occupation lasted 36 hours. The women were mostly relatives and friends of the 1,700 union miners on strike against Pittston. The women, when questioned by police and the media, refused to give up their names. They called themselves the Daughters of Mother Jones. Though Sauls had never worked in the mines, six of her brothers and two of her sisters had. She and many family members would sit down in front of Moss 3 preparation plant just weeks later. As the strike wore on, her husband Doug would be one of the union strikers who took over and occupied Pittston's Moss 3 plant later that fall. Sauls noted the high personal stakes at Pittston, stating, "My husband is 42 years old. He's worked in the mines for 24 years. Who is going to hire him for another job?" Sauls also rose to local fame during the strike when she began writing strike solidarity songs. One such song was Let Me In, also referred to as the Camo Song, for the strikers who wore camouflage. Sauls composed the song after she found a child crying whose striking grandfather had been jailed. In the song, the child asks to go to jail too. The daughters picketed Pittston offices twice a week and organized strike support that included housing, food drives, and fundraising. Their role inspired miners to occupy the mines and roads, persevere throughout the winter, and eventually win back health benefits.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
These days, America's top economic officials tend to speak in intelligible bureaucratic gobbledygook. But once upon a time, there was a plain-spoken White House economist, and he even had a sense of humor. He didn't last. Alfred Kahn was chastised by the White House in 1978 for speaking clearly and honestly about the looming possibility of a depression. "Too blunt, use softer words." So Kahn started calling the downturn a looming banana. When banana industry lobbyists complained, he switched to kumquat. In that spirit, let me warn you about an unemployment taco that the autocratic Federal Reserve System is cooking up for working families. The Fed, as it's called by jolly bankers who run it, say it's imposing, quote, the restoration between supply and demand in the labor market. They soothingly add that there will very likely be some softening in the labor market conditions. You can almost hear them humming Rockabye Baby. But don't nod off. As Bryce Covert, the insightful economic digger and truth-teller, recently explained, there's nothing soft about the Fed's arbitrary policy. It means fewer raises and more people out of work, which means about 1.5 million people will lose their jobs. She documents that, historically, such a jolt of unemployment will probably, get ready for scary words, trigger a recession. Or a taco, if that makes you feel better. The mumbo-jumbo of economists aside, what we have here is the same old power play of moneyed elites putting the jobs and wages of working families on the chopping block to jack up the exorbitant profits of monopolistic corporations. When the Fed bankers say they're restoring balance, they mean restoring the power of corporate bosses to rule unilaterally over America's workaday majority. This is Jim Hightower saying, in plain language, this is blatant class war by the privileged few against the many.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Goldman Sachs is even weighing in on this, saying that we're going to hit the debt limit first half of June. And again, what they're asking for, I mean, you go back to John Boehner and his Screwquester, this is even worse than that. They're talking 22% cut to the VA. In fact, Jesse Lee, the senior advisor for communications at the National Economic Council, he has confirmed that House Republicans have no carve-outs for vets. He says their bill says VA must cut by 22% or they're not moving the debt ceiling, which means chaos, which means real pain and suffering for our economy. And that's why I've asked Karen Dolan to come talk with us. Karen is the director of the Criminalization of Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, the website. Karen, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's my pleasure.
So this number to me, unconscionable. I mean, just these are the people who every time there are soldiers around or a flag, there's a photo op to be had. They put folks up on a pedestal and now they're kicking them right in the behind off. This is unconscionable to me.
It is. And there are all kinds of ways in which they are hurting vets. So as you mentioned, the 22% cut to veterans' health. Also, when you cut back on how Social Security and Medicare is administered, you have longer wait times, you have not answers with questions. When you put work requirements into Medicaid and food stamps and SNAP, that affects veterans greatly. So there's really a number of ways in which veterans are hurt by this proposal.
Yeah, I mean, the VA, and we talk about this all the time, the VA is already well understaffed, and this is going to cause even more staffing cuts. Last I talked to the folks from AFGE, they said there are 50,000 people, 50,000 workers who should be working at the VA to lessen wait times, to get more people seen, to deal with more issues that aren't there. This would cause that to be worse and make wait times much longer, and all the negative things worse.
That's right. There's nothing reasonable about this proposal. First of all, to step back, we should never put any contingencies on paying our debts, which have already been accrued. This raising the debt ceiling has nothing to do with the budget. If they want to have these kinds of discussions, and budget discussions would be the appropriate place to have them, not with debt ceiling.
Right.
Debt ceiling is simply about paying the debts of the money that was already agreed by both parties at the end of December for fiscal year 23. And you can't simply say, oh, you know, we already required this money to be spent, but we're not going to pay it. That's completely the wrong way to go about it.
No,
so from the get-go, they're absolutely wrong, and it's a threat to the entire economy, even to the global economy.
No, it's crazy. And you look at this, the McCarthy bill, the Limit, Save, Grow Act of 2023, which, okay, they're saying they're going to cut discretionary funding, going to retrieve some unspent pandemic money, eliminate Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, and go after the IRS money. And they say that's going to be $4.5 trillion that they're going to be able to cut. And my mind goes, I know discretionary spending is only about 35% of the money that we of our budget, and over like 68% of that is military homeland security. So to get this kind of a cut, $4.5 trillion, there's pain and suffering for a lot of working poor people in this country.
Oh, it's nothing but pain and suffering. And then they're capping spending at 1% for the next 10 years. That doesn't even keep up with inflation. So it gets exponentially more painful as with every year. And make no mistake, they're not doing this for fiscal responsibility. They're doing this to free up money to make the Trump tax cuts for the very wealthy and big corporations permanent.
Yep.
There are no revenue raisers on the table. So when you hear them say, kind of trying to be folksy, that we have to balance our own family budgets, well, we don't balance our own family budgets without income. We go to work. And they're demanding that veterans and people that have some challenges getting to work, that they do work in exchange for being able to access health care if they're poor, or food if they're poor. Yet the Republican proposal itself calls for zero revenues, Just taking from the poor to feed the rich is the only thing they're doing.
Yeah, no, and we've been talking about this the last couple of days. The reality is you look at the Bush and the Trump tax cuts, that's $10 trillion right there. You undo that, we don't have a problem. In fact, we could do all the things that we're not doing. We can make all the investments in the future that we're not doing. We can help poor people not be poor. And we learned that coming out of the pandemic. We learned how to alleviate poverty. We learned how to make sure that no child goes to bed hungry, that no veteran goes to sleep on the street. We can solve these problems. We choose not to.
That's exactly right. We choose not to. And even if the top 1% of income earners in this country paid their fair share of taxes the way the rest of us do, we would have no more poverty in this country. Just if the top 1% paid what they owed, if they paid their fair share.
Yeah, I'm not on the fair share bandwagon. I'm on the let's dig up the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. When the country was its strongest, it was when we had a progressive tax code that said the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry. The more that you're given, the more that's expected of you. I don't know what fair share means, but I do know that we shouldn't have gazillionaires who have the power of someone like Musk or Bezos. I do know that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Eisenhower was a Republican president, and the tax rate was 90% or 91% for high income earners. And we don't have anything like that now. And what we have now is billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, paying less than you or I or our child's teacher or the firefighter down the street. And it's obscene. And Donald Trump himself increased the deficit by $8 trillion just in 4 years, whereas Joe Biden has decreased the deficit. So these talking points that they're trotting out in this folksy language that they think will appeal to people are straight up lies.
Yeah. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Karen Dolan. Karen is the director of the Criminalization of Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, the website if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Let's say they get their cuts, Karen. What does that look like? I mean, because you hear discretionary budgets, there's all these terms being thrown around that most people don't really grasp. When we think about the budget, you think about the big number. When you realize it, that you know almost two-thirds of our budget is mandatory spending. There's nothing you can do about it. It's Social Security, it's Medicare, it's Medicaid, it's all those things that's the spending. Our discretionary side of this, like I said, 68% of it is military, Homeland Security. The rest of that they want to slash and burn, what does that mean for working people?
Right. And they're not going to slash the military budget. So the military budget is obscenely high, and they will not slash that at all. And that will continue at least a 9% annual growth. So, I mean, that's another way in which this is very obscene. But what it's going to, if these cuts and proposals went through, which they won't, but we can talk about why they're still important. They won't right now, but they could in 2024. What it would mean is exorbitantly higher childcare costs, preschool costs, education costs, college costs, less food on the table, less healthcare, more uninsured people. Any way in which we who live, you know, an average life, paycheck to paycheck or a little bit above, we're going to be drastically affected. And even though they say that they're not touching Social Security and Medicare, these cuts would drastically reduce the staff that administers these programs. And that will cause all kinds of problems in terms of being able to get people the help that they are eligible for and able to answer questions, being able to administer the programs.
Yeah.
So it's really quite disastrous. Now, in its current form, it won't pass the Senate. But what could happen is that there are conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, who's now an independent, some of the people in swing states like John Tester, who could say, you know what, I could really live with work requirements in you know, in Medicaid or something, you know, that they think will appeal to their base. We've never had work requirements in exchange for poor people getting health care. They tried it in Arkansas, and it was a complete failure. Trump tried to pass it, and the court struck it down. It's immoral to require things that people aren't able to do in order for them to have health care and food. And everybody who can work is already working. 75% of people on SNAP work. They work one or two jobs, and the people that are left that don't are disabled, have some health problem, are seniors, and are unable to work. The people that can work are already working. So this is just cruelty.
Yeah. See, I'm not opposed to a work requirement, but if there is a work requirement, there's got to be work. So I've always said, if you're going to mandate a work requirement, government's got to be employer of last resort, because the private sector is never going to create enough jobs for everyone to have one. So there's going to have to be a system. If you're going to mandate this, there's got to be a way to people having a default. Okay, I can get a job, you know, doing whatever. But none of that ever happens. I mean, you look at when Clinton signed the welfare reform bill in the 90s. They tried to do that. There was no work for people. And there was no way to get to the work. And there were so many structural things and that they've done pretty much away with it over the years. But this is my problem. It's that talking point, as you pointed out, that gets the middle class and the people are doing okay to look with a jaundiced eye at the poor, going thinking they're getting something that they're not. And at some point, I think we've got to push back on that. Does that make sense?
That's right. Well, there's a couple of things in there. One is that's important to note is that people who can work already are working. People do work. It's a myth to say that they don't. Secondly, it's a different argument to me. It's a moral argument to say that somebody who's sick cannot get health care in this country unless they meet a certain work requirement. To me, those things should be completely separate. People should have health care. That's a human right. And then thirdly, study after study has shown that work requirements do not increase employment because people are already working. What you need, what can help people get, people need better jobs, they need support at their jobs, they need more education. So go underneath it and support people in the way that they can stay at a job, that they can get a job that enables them to be also take care of their children. We can't force people into work when they've got to take care of children or elderly parents or they've got some health problems. And it's a problem that doesn't exist. So this is a solution in search of a problem.
I agree.
So I think that those things are really important to point out. Yes, everybody believes in the power of work. People feel dignity and self-worth when they work. And people who receive benefits work. It's just that the wages are low and rents are extremely high. And you've got now the end of the pandemic supports. You've got high inflation. You've got these social programs, these social investments have not caught up to 2010 levels before that recession and that Budget Control Act that imposed all these austerity cuts back then. So these programs are still underfunded. They're funded below what they were in 2010. So you're trying to impose cuts on top of that. Well, we should be trying to get back up to where we are. So there are too many obstacles for this, any piece of this proposal to make any sense.
I want to reiterate what you just said there, because I think it's really important, because I have my Republican friends saying, you know, we're spending all this money. We've never spent more money. We're spending all this stuff. And, you know, they believe there's an office of waste, fraud and abuse that we could just cut them right off. Are we spending more money than we have? Does that talking point hold water? Because the way I see it, we're spending about half of what we spent off of the peak because of just what you said, these constant, the screw questers, the constant, you know, holding things back, restraining things and holding it under inflation like we've done with the minimum wage. I'm curious, do you buy into that?
I don't buy into that, and here's why. It's a question of priorities. Where we're spending our money is in tax breaks for the wealthy and high and big corporations and on an obscenely bloated Pentagon budget. That is where the spending is with no revenues coming in. So what you have to do is right-size that spending, slash the Pentagon budget, for goodness sake, and then bring in revenues.
Yeah.
If you don't do those things, then of course you're going to be in a situation where all you can do is extract pounds of flesh and gallons of blood from the people who can least afford to give it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think we have to slash the Pentagon's budget, but I do think we need to tax the rich and use that money to move us forward. So as this hostage situation continues, is there a plan B? Is there an off ramp? Because I got to think you've got the Republicans, their cult caucus, who I believe want to shoot the hostage. You've got Biden that seems like, and I'm glad he is, he's dug in saying, no, we're not going to screw over the middle class and the working poor. Is there an off-ramp to this, do you think?
There is an off-ramp, and I really wish that it would be the first step rather than what so-called moderate Republicans. There are a few moderate Republicans in the House who are working with Democrats to have a plan B, exactly, which is a clean debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling without conditions, as should be done, as the Republicans have done 49 times. And they even suspended the debt ceiling under Trump so he could get through all the tax breaks for the rich. But they have a proposal to get through a clean debt ceiling raising until the end of the year. But they're using that as a backstop in case this extremist proposal from the Freedom Caucus in the House and Biden and Schumer can't make some kind of a deal. Whereas what they should do out of the gate is just pass that.
Yeah.
We should not be playing political football with the debt ceiling, with the full faith and credit of the United States. That will cause so much misery to you and me, to every single one of your listeners, and to global economy. It's just utter foolishness.
Nope, stupidity. And what I would have liked to see, what I'd like to see, is to do away with the debt ceiling.
Yeah,
get rid
too.
Of it entirely. This is not a toy. This isn't a bomb we should have in our arsenal. There are enough ways to screw
anything
up our economy.
Well, that's right. And the debt ceiling is just a political tool. You know, it was created in 1917 in response to World War I. It has no bearing on the real economy. So it means nothing. It even includes it includes revenues that the Treasury has. It when the Social Security Trust Fund goes up, the debt limit gets squeezed. So it has no bearing to the real economy. It is simply used as a hostage-taking tool by the Republicans when they aren't in power. When they are in power, they're all for suspending, losing, raising, get rid of it so they can get their tax cuts through. But when they're not in power, it is simply a political tool, and that is the only thing it's used for.
It's amazing how that works. But Karen, I appreciate you taking some time. I'm sure this is going to continue. Would love to have you come back and keep us up to date on the goings-on.
Great. Thanks so much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Karen Dolan. She is the director of the Criminalization of Poverty Project there at the Institute for Policy Studies. Check out their website, ips-dc.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the first observation of Earth Day. Across the United States, millions of people took to the streets and parks to demonstrate for clean air, water, and a reduction in pollution and care for nature and the environment. The idea for Earth Day began with Democratic Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson. He was inspired to action when he witnessed the devastation caused by an oil spill in Santa Barbara, California. Senator Nelson knew for the day to be a success, he needed to reach across the aisle. He found an ally in Republican Congressman Pete McCloskey. He also found support from organized labor. The national coordinator for Earth Day was Dennis Hayes. Hayes explained, quote, "Without the UAW, the first Earth Day would have likely flopped. The UAW was by far the largest contributor to the first Earth Day, and its support went beyond the merely financial. It printed and mailed all of our material at its expense, even those critical of pollution-belching cars. 20 years later, Earth Day truly went global. In 1990, it was estimated that 200 million people from 141 countries participated in Earth Day actions. President Bill Clinton awarded Senator Nelson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor granted to a U.S. civilian for his role in Earth Day. The role of the United Auto Workers in the first Earth Day demonstrates the importance that labor can play in the environmental movement.
All things and what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So some good news for the folks out in Pittsburgh. There will be baseball on Thursday. I was going to talk about a story yesterday where the Pittsburgh Stadium Independent Employees Union, they represent the ticket takers, the ushers, the ticket sellers, the people who work at the stadium in Pittsburgh. They had authorized a strike. And look, you know, the reality is these folks, they got to make a living like everybody else. You got these ballparks and these teams making, you know, gazillions amounts of money. It should trickle down. It should. I know the president said, you know, trickle down economics doesn't work. It works when you demand it works. It works when you've got the power to say, you know what? No ticky, no laundry. Remember that saying? You don't pay us, we're not coming to work. And that's what these workers did. And it got me thinking, because I remember I had done a radio interview. It's got to be 10, 12 years ago. I was on another show and someone called in and said, hey, I'm an insurance agent. How do I start my own union? And I was, you know, going through the process of, you know, what you would have to do to start a union, that you'd, you know, you'd have to, you know, organize your workplace. You've got to petition the Department of Labor. This was during the Trump years. I guess it wasn't that long ago. It was during the early Trump year. And I said, look, you've got to organize the workplace. You've got to, you know, come together. You've got to petition the boss. There's a whole bunch of process to go through this. And I was, you know, why would you say that? You know, the Trump, you can't do that. You know, just go with the existing unions. And I was going, no, I do see, and this was, you know, years ago, I do see a movement of workers saying, you know what, in our workplace, we're going to come together, which is what was supposed to happen, which is what happened in the 30s and 40s. And eventually they affiliate with the bigger legacy unions, but the passion, the move forward, the engagement is local, hyper-local. And you look at all of these different places like the Pittsburgh Stadium Independent Employees Union. These are just the people who work there saying, look, we're gonna demand better wages, hours, conditions, because that's what it's about. I look at Workers United. Workers United was the group that started the Starbucks unionization campaign in Buffalo. They were a startup. They now are organizing the Ben & Jerry's. And here's the thing that gets me. Ben & Jerry's, love Ben & Jerry's. And I love them even more now, saying that, look, you know what? Go ahead. We support it. We support you organizing our retail shop in Burlington. We support you. If the workers want it, we're okay with it. To me, this is the way forward in, you know, making these employers understand that it's in their best economic interest to allow workers to organize. And I've been saying for a while that, you know, if done right, like you see a lot in the building trades where the contractors and the employees, they have similar wants and needs and they work together. It can be a harmonious relationship. It can be one of mutual benefit. The problem is the wealth class doesn't want that. They don't want to share. They want it all. And they'll give you whatever they think you're worth. And the thing that's always been amazing to me is, you know, the people who tell me, we don't need no stinking unions, complain about how little they make. And there's part of me that goes, that's all they think they're worth. You know, I believe working people are worth a good portion of the wealth that their labor creates. And knowing what your labor creates is an important component of that. And that's what unions, that's what collective bargaining is about. It's about opening up the books and going, okay, this is what our labor created. This is what your labor created. How about we divvy up this a little bit more equitably so that I can support my family? I can put a roof over their head, food on the table, can pay the bills, maybe a vacation every once in a while. Maybe, oh, I don't know, kid go to college. Maybe, I don't know, save for retirement. Maybe, whatever. Sadly, what's happening, working people are getting screwed.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.